Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. Last month, the video service Netflix and the cable internet provider Comcast cut a content delivery deal. It was the first big agreement of its kind since a federal appeals court struck down rules designed to protect the notion of net neutrality. The main tenet of net neutrality is that companies providing internet service should not selectively slow down or speed up the delivery of content from certain sources. But in this case, Netflix appears to be paying Comcast to ensure that Netflix video moves smoothly along its pathway to viewers. This weekend, it was reported that Apple is trying to work a similar deal with Comcast. It all raises some important questions. What does it mean if the flow of the internet becomes stratified and media companies are paying to ensure fast delivery of their content? Will what we be able to watch continue to move without us having to pay a lot more to view it? And what or who will determine which internet data flows to your home quickly and which information might get stalled? Our guest today will help us better understand the issues at hand. First in the studio, we have David Mandy. He's an economics professor and the department chair at the University of Missouri. Welcome to our program, David Mandy.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Joining us via Skype is Dana Woolman. She's the managing editor of Engadget, a web magazine that provides daily coverage of consumer electronics. Welcome to our program, Dana Woolman.
Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you with us. And also joining us via Skype, Ken Florence is Vice President of Content Delivery at Netflix. Welcome to our program, Ken Florence.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you with us as well. And for those of you in our audience, what do you think? Should internet streaming capacity be available to everyone equally? And if not, how should it get divvied out? You can give us a call at 573-882-8925, or you can email us at intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us. Our handle is at IntersectKBIA. Ken, I want to start with you, if we could. How did the deal with Comcast come about?
Essentially, we've been speaking with Comcast over an extended period of time. We launched our dedicated content delivery network that we call Open Connect a couple of years ago. And so we've had ongoing dialogue with kind of all the major ISPs in the U.S. and other markets in which we operate. And so the deal was a progression of those discussions.
And what can you tell us about the deal in terms of what Netflix gets out of it and what Comcast gets out of it?
So it's important to realize that this deal doesn't get us any special access to the Comcast network. It's just a direct connection to the Comcast network. And so it's a similar connection that many other networks and content delivery networks have to that network. And there's a different dimension that we can probably get into later about the extent to which money should change hands in those kinds of interactions. And some of your listeners may be aware that we published a blog post recently outlining our position in terms of how we think these kinds of arrangements affect the broader question of network neutrality.
Right. And for those of you who haven't seen, for our audience members, I mean, who haven't seen that blog post, can you summarize a little bit of Netflix's position on this?
Yeah, it's essentially that users who are being sold an internet service, say you're paying 20 megabits for a 20 megabit per second internet plan, that you should be able to access services on the internet at that rate. And what in fact happens is a little different. So to just give a little background on that, think about the internet as, you know, a collection of networks that are connected to each other. And so the first network you deal with when you're connected to your at home is from your home to your ISP. And then your ISP has to connect with the rest of the internet. And so frequently, if you run a speed test at home, say you're just connected, you're just testing that connection from your house to the ISP's data center. And then there's a different question of how well is that ISP interconnected with other networks on the internet. And so our position is that people who are paying for that kind of interconnect for an ISP plan at home should be able to access services on the internet at a rate that's commensurate with the rate that they're paying for. And so content providers such as ourselves, YouTube, you know, and other networks that interconnect with those ISP networks should be able to do so without additional charges.
And when you say ISP, that's the Comcast of the world, the people who actually send the internet line into people's homes, right?
Exactly.
And so, you know, a lot of this talk of net neutrality is about what they're doing. I mean, what is the role that they play in terms of the Netflix content? I mean, how does what you're sending through their pipeline fit with all the other stuff that they're delivering to people's homes?
Yeah, so Comcast is interconnected with a number of different networks that kind of represent the rest of the internet. Comcast is just one example, and like you say, there are many ISPs that people can use to connect to the internet from their homes. And so, essentially, Comcast plays a role in delivering that traffic, and our position is that those kinds of interconnections to enable users to reach other services should be just based on both networks working together to provide sufficient capacity so that users have access to the internet at the speeds they're trying to achieve.
Right. Dana, are you still with us?
Absolutely.
Great. Okay. I wanted to hear your thoughts a little bit on this relationship between somebody like Netflix and the internet service providers that are sending content into people's houses. What's your understanding of what this deal represents going forward?
It's the Comcast deal was definitely a slippery slope. That one deal is not the last that we're going to see. It's definitely only the first. In fact, I read recently that Netflix made a similar deal with an ISP in Norway, actually, and that similar deals are underway, or at least discussions are underway with other major ISPs in the U.S. And that makes sense from an ISP perspective. They see what Comcast has achieved and want something similar. In fact, AT&T recently put out a statement defending the ISP position, sort of in negotiations, not just with Netflix, but definitely with Netflix being sort of the poster child for these kinds of discussions, basically arguing that someone has to pay for this extra bandwidth and that it's services like Netflix, very video heavy services, obviously, that require this much bandwidth. And I definitely, I can see both sides. I definitely think someone has to pay for it. I don't know if it's going to have to be Netflix eventually. It looks like it might be Netflix in the short term or the ISPs. It's clear someone has to pay for it. My concern is that that isn't used as an excuse to slow down Netflix traffic, potentially to favor a competing service. And that's, I think, been the concern of many online and consumer groups who have fought for net neutrality.
Right. Ken, do you agree? Do you feel like you're starting down a slippery slope by having to work deals with individual ISPs?
Yeah, so I agree with many of the points that Dana just made. Essentially, and we refer to this in the blog post that we put up recently about network neutrality. The reason we had to do a deal with Comcast was because we were seeing significant degradation of our service on their network. And so to Dana's point about kind of who pays for this, it seems pretty clear to us that users are already paying. So folks at home are already paying for their Comcast connection, as an example. And they're paying for, as I said before, something like 15 megabits, 20 megabits, 30 megabits, whatever package they happen to be paying for. And so if you think about that, the fastest stream that Netflix has for a full high definition picture is about 6 megabits. And so, you know, it seems pretty straightforward that if you're paying for a 20 megabit plan, you should easily be able to watch at least 1 6-megabit stream at full quality. And what we were seeing is actually that was not the case, that the various networks coming into Comcast's network were frequently congested. And so especially at peak hours, you know, prime time when everybody's trying to watch whatever content they're accessing, we would see quality degrade significantly during those times.
And what and do you so, suppose? What do you suppose was behind that in terms of the Netflix content on that network not being completely smooth?
So it's essentially, you know, if we take a step back and say, okay, the dialogue around net neutrality has traditionally been that if you are accessing the internet, you should be able to access any service. Services should not be discriminated against, you know, one service preferred over another. And when internet neutrality rules were implemented, for instance, the open internet order that the FCC implemented that was recently vacated by the courts, those rules essentially said within your ISP's network, so within the network of the ISP that you use to connect the internet from home, they're not allowed to kind of play games with traffic. They're not allowed to speed some people up, slow people down, block some services, allow others. What those rules didn't account for, and so in our position on network neutrality, we've referred to that as kind of a weak network neutrality position. It's important that networks don't kind of mess with traffic that's coming across their network, but it's not sufficient to provide users a great experience. And in fact, there's very little evidence, aside from years ago when there was some blocking of peer-to-peer network, there's very little evidence that that kind of discrimination inside ISP networks has happened. There's a different kind of there's a different part of how the internet works that's at play here that we've referred to as broad net neutrality, which includes the ISP providing sufficient capacity to satisfy the requests that are being made by the folks at home. So if you're at home and you're trying to access Facebook or YouTube or Netflix or, you know, any one of a number of different services, there are different networks that those services are going to come down to eventually get to the ISP's network and then your house. And so what's happened is, rather than discriminating based on, you know, actually manipulating traffic within their network, a lot of the actual discrimination has happened by kind of selectively deciding to add capacity or not add capacity to various external networks based on whether those networks pay them or not.
Okay, I want to come back and continue, but I need to remind all of our audience that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. Today, we look at the issue of net neutrality and whether all information on the internet will continue to enjoy the same unfettered pathway into our homes. Joining us via Skype are Ken Florence, Vice President of Content Delivery at Netflix, who you just heard from, and Dana Woolman, Managing Editor of the online magazine Engadget. In the studio, we also have with us Dave Mandy, Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri. We hope to hear from you in our audience as well. Should companies that move large amounts of data across the internet have to pay extra for that, or should internet capacity be equally available to everyone? We'd like to hear what you think. Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet us. Our handle is @intersectkbia. We'd like to remind you also that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online, as long as your ISP gives you that bandwidth, during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2. You can find us at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. David, I want to bring you into the conversation a little bit. This discussion over what the internet service providers should provide, the bandwidth and the access to stuff, this is not the first time that the FCC has been involved in something like this, right?
No, it's really a very old question. I mean, it goes at least, well, it really goes back into the 19th century, but you know, it was sort of this kind of issue was the foundation for telecommunications regulation throughout a good part of the 20th century, when we had mostly AT&T, but some other telecom companies as well, being heavily regulated by both state and federal regulatory authorities in an attempt to make sure that the services provided were of a sufficient quality and people were charged reasonable prices. And all of this is the sort of backdrop for all of this is the notion that if you only have one or a few providers, there may not be enough competition to make sure that the end users get what they want at a price that reasonably reflects the cost of providing the service, and also some fair rate of return for the companies involved. For many years in the United States, AT&T was really the only provider of telecommunication services in large parts of the country, and during that whole time they were very heavily regulated because they were a monopoly provider. And that's really, at its most fundamental economic level, you could say that's what's going on in the current debate over net neutrality. If only we had 10 ISPs into every house, we probably wouldn't be having this discussion. They'd be fighting for customers and trying to provide exactly what customers want, and the competition would have them charging whatever it costs to make that happen.
Well, why don't we have 10 ISPs going into everyone's houses?
This is really fundamentally a question about the cost structure of providing these kinds of services. If you have to run wires out into every house, it's very expensive. And that kind of provision of service, you could think about it as almost like running water pipes out to people's houses to provide water service. It doesn't make a lot of sense to run two water pipes out to each house just so you have water companies competing with each other. So it's the kind of service that fundamentally is provided at lowest cost by one or only a few providers. Otherwise, you get a lot of duplication. And when you have that, then you have to sort of figure out how you're going to protect the users from what might be, and I don't want to say this is really happening, but what might be abuses of the market power on the part of the players involved.
Right. Dana, I'm curious your thoughts on this in terms of how we got where we are and why we're here.
So I think definitely to go back to the to use the AT&T analogy is a really great place to start. Right now, I think we are at a point where we expect ISPs like Comcast and Verizon to be treated the same way telecommunications companies are treated now, almost as dumb pipes. But that's not the way the law is written. The law, in the eyes of the law, ISPs are not dumb pipes. And that's why you do have this I think that's why the net neutrality policies are what they are today, where you can expect perhaps different speeds on different networks. Different networks might treat different services like Netflix at their discretion, work out their own individual deals. We're just not at a point right now where ISPs are treated like agnostic, neutral vehicles, vessels through which we can get this information. I would hope that one day we do move in that direction. I think right now a lot of people already expect ISPs to work that way, but we're not there yet. And that is why the law, the net neutrality laws, are what they are today.
Right.
As disappointing as they are to some people.
Right. Ken, I want to ask you this. How did Netflix get to be the poster child on all of this?
Because we are responsible for a large volume of the traffic on the internet. So, if you, you know, and we happen to be very early in the subscription video, market, and it's a service that's a relatively low cost that a lot of people enjoy. So we have a lot of, subscribers that like to watch Netflix every night, and if you add all those up together, it creates a decent amount of volume of traffic on the internet.
How much traffic exactly? Can you tell us some ballpark figure there, or maybe an exact figure?
We're generally not too kind of precise about that, but it's in the multiple terabits per second. It's important to know, though, that some of the issues raised by David, raised by Dana, about monopolies and kind of how that bears on the evolution of a marketplace, I think are very relevant here. And so one of the things that, you know, we aspire to do is to be able to provide technologies that make it very cost effective for ISPs to be able to deliver Netflix traffic. So when, you know, there's been studies published that says Netflix is as much as a third of the bandwidth on last mile networks during peak times, because it's one of the most popular services, obviously. But it's important to realize that that doesn't mean Netflix is using a third of the whole internet. It means that on local networks, network is very popular, you know, during peak hours. And we actually, Netflix actually provides free of charge servers that ISPs can locate in their data centers, or connections that ISPs can connect directly to in localities all around the U.S., where they can get our traffic for free at high quality in a way that's very, very inexpensive for their network to deliver. And so what we'd like to see is that the economics of internet delivery evolve in a way where companies like Netflix and Comcast can work together to essentially do the engineering to provide all the benefits of technological advances. You know, this kind of technology tends to advance along a Moore's Law kind of scale of efficiency, where, you know, you get a lot more out of your technology every year in terms of capability at a lower cost. And, you know, if companies like Netflix and Comcast can work on that engineering together without this potential monopoly issue of being able to kind of one party or the other extract more value because of the position they're in, we think that's the right way for the internet to grow.
Okay, let me remind our audience again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Famuliner. Today we're talking about challenges to net neutrality and what happens when all information on the internet might not get treated equally. Joining us via Skype are Ken Florence, Vice President of Content Delivery at Netflix, and Dana Woolman, Managing Editor of the online magazine Engadget. And in the studio we have with us David Mandy, Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri. We hope to hear from you and our audience as well. Does it make sense to charge companies for streaming capacity, or does that put us on a slippery slope? We'd like to hear what you think. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also send us an email at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet us. Our handle is @IntersectKBIA. David, I want to continue on the line of thought there. How much is it incumbent on somebody like Netflix to reduce the amount of bandwidth you need for your content delivery versus the ISPs, the internet companies, to increase the amount of information they can send into people's homes?
Well, I think it's a company like Netflix has all the incentives they need, really, to try to make their service flow into people's homes as smoothly as possible. So, I mean, that they're not really the monopoly player in this kind of setting, and I think you can pretty much rely on them pursuing their own interests to do what they can. The issue is really on the as we say, the last mile of wire, where a lot of end users only have one or maybe two choices about who to buy their service from. I want to go back to something Dana mentioned earlier. Somewhere along the way, all of this capacity, whoever provides it, it has to be paid for. And this is an issue that was present through all the long years when AT&T was the main monopoly provider of telecommunications in the United States. One of the problems with regulation of an industry like that is that when the government steps in and starts saying how it's going to be, you can get lots of strange quirks, some of which are motivated by a political environment rather than what's good economics. And over time, these things build up and you can just have some very unintended outcomes. If you think back to the way, for example, you made a long-distance call in 1970, you basically didn't make very many because it was really expensive. It was much more expensive for the consumer than it really cost, because what the regulations were doing was skimming revenues off of things like long-distance and business services in order to subsidize the provision of basic phone lines into people's homes. That would never happen in a competitive marketplace. Those kinds of cross subsidies couldn't survive competitive pressures. Nowadays, you know, we make long distance calls and we don't even think about it. In fact, you know, depending on your phone plan, it might be virtually free for you to make a long distance call compared to what it costs to make a local call.
And in some cases, those long distance calls are moving through these internet pipelines, right?
There is that as well. These technologies are all merging.
Dana, somebody has to pay for all this capacity. Who do you think it should be?
It's a complicated question, but so far I have not seen strong enough arguments that it should be Netflix. I'm going to quote here from a statement from AT&T. It says, he says, Mr. Jim Ciccone says here, I thought it might be helpful to unpack those assertions so we could get right down to the core of Netflix's rather radical proposition that people who don't subscribe to Netflix should nonetheless pay for Netflix. You know, going back a little bit toward, you know, back, you know, to telecom companies or even to these very cable companies, which are now serving up internet, but were previously for many years and continue to serve up cable channels. We see periodically certain very contentious battles over, let's say, retransmission fees. I'm paying for ESPN right now. I don't watch a lick of ESPN. I never do. So I don't really see – this seems to me like somewhat of a weak argument, the idea that people shouldn't have to pay for Netflix if they're not using Netflix.
And let me just clarify that. When you say people who are not using Netflix paying for Netflix, you mean the subscribers to internet services paying to expand the bandwidth so that Netflix can stream
movies?
Yes,
the idea that not all Comcast subscribers, let's say, are – also Netflix subscribers, that there might be some Comcast subscribers who don't use Netflix, and therefore none of the costs of supporting Netflix should be passed down to them. That does seem to me like a weak argument, just given the precedent of the precedent with the way we treat certain cable channels right now. I am paying for ESPN. I am supporting ESPN. I don't watch ESPN. I fail to see a major difference here. And so, this does seem like a weak argument to me.
So are you saying that the price to have high-speed internet in one's home should go up and that should be used to expand the bandwidth? I mean, I just want to make sure I understand you clearly on this, that the individual subscribers to internet services are the ones that ought to pay for this via higher rates or what?
This is Ken. I could try.
Yeah, Ken, I'd love to hear your input here too.
Sure.
So, just before we do that, I mean, is that what you were saying, Dana? I just want to make sure that we hear you clearly.
Again, it's a complicated issue, but I would like to see a stronger argument that it should be Netflix. I think if that is the core of AT&T's argument, just to use AT&T as an example, if that is the core of their argument, I don't think it is a particularly strong argument. So at the very least, I'd like to see some stronger arguments for why Netflix should be the one to pay for this.
Okay. Ken, I'm going to guess that you're going to say that Netflix shouldn't.
Yeah, that's probably a safe bet. I think there's some real rationality to that, though. You know, one point that's left out of that AT&T argument is that, in fact, their subscribers are already paying for that service. So a great question for AT&T along the lines of that argument is, well, if I'm paying you for your UVerse 20 megabit service, why don't I have access to Netflix at 6 megabits? You know, so that's the real question. It's not that, you know, so every single user is already paying AT&T for that service. They're paying AT&T for data rates that are much in excess of the data rates that are required to stream high-quality Netflix to your home.
Okay, I've got to jump in here and set us up for a break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Reuben Stern, filling in for Ryan Muehlener. Today we're talking about net neutrality and the ways that that might change over the next several years. We're going to take a quick break, but hopefully you'll stick around and join us after the break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Famuliner. Today we're talking about net neutrality and the way that internet bandwidth is allocated to individual users and content providers. Joining us in the studio is David Mandy, professor of economics at the University of Missouri. And via Skype, we have Dana Woolman, the managing editor of the online magazine Engadget. And we also have with us on Skype, Ken Florence, who is the vice president of content delivery for Netflix. For those of you in our audience, we hope you'll join our conversation as well. Should the internet be regulated, perhaps like a utility, such as electricity or water, or does it belong to the companies who build the infrastructure? We'd love to hear your thoughts on that. So give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet us. Our handle is @intersectkbia. Before the break, we were listening to Ken talk a little bit about Netflix's position on who pays for the expansion of infrastructure to make sure that all of this great content that people want to view from various providers gets to their homes. Ken, I want to let you finish that in terms of how you envision that getting sorted out.
Yeah, so I think the essential point is really, you know, it's easy to get caught up in this argument that companies like Netflix are sending a bunch of data to AT&T, for instance, and therefore we should pay for it. But I think if you take a step back and look at kind of how it's actually working, AT&T subscribers are paying AT&T to get access to the internet. Netflix never delivers a single smidgen of traffic onto AT&T's network, except where it's requested by an AT&T subscriber. So the real answer, I think, is AT&T subscribers, for instance, are already paying for that internet. And so AT&T should work with the various other networks and content providers on the internet to make sure that that delivery happens kind of as smoothly and as efficiently as possible. The other model would be, you know, which has kind of been alluded to in both ways here, either companies like Netflix would have to pay, in which case, unfortunately, I think that creates an environment where some can afford to pay and others aren't. It's kind of not the internet as the great platform for innovation that we all hope it continues to be. The other potential model is services like Netflix say, you know what, your server subscribers on your network want our content, you should pay us in the way that you know, the current retransmission fees work on cable networks. There's a great history of things not working that way in the internet. In from the beginning of the internet, most network interconnections happened on what's called a settlement-free basis, meaning neither party paid the other because there was a relatively equal exchange of value, content coming and going, subscriber access coming and going, and that created a good balance where the internet could scale just based on, you know, doing the proper engineering, and every time additional capacity was required, it was just a matter of building that capacity rather than an opportunity for a renegotiation. And so we certainly hope that that's the track that the internet stays on long term. It's the way it works with the majority of networks, except the very largest ones who have who kind of tend toward that monopoly type access that David was referring to earlier.
Okay, I want to jump in on two of those points. So first thing, the idea that we might go down the path where only big players can afford to pay the ISPs to get their stuff through the system. Aren't we already there with the deal that you all just signed and Apple now trying to lock in a deal with Comcast as well? Aren't we moving down that road already?
Yeah, so what we've said, yeah, I think unfortunately to some extent we are. What we've said in our posting on our position on internet neutrality is we did that deal, and we will do future deals like that when we see that service is being dramatically degraded to our subscribers. In other words, we'll try and put our subscribers first and make sure that we're continuing to deliver a great experience. But we still don't think that that's the right long-term path for the internet. We think the right long-term path for the internet is, you know, as a continued platform for innovation, as a level playing field. Netflix has done very well on a level playing field, and we continue to think we would do so in the future.
Right. David, maybe I'll ask you this. What's the incentive for other internet service providers to do anything different than what Comcast has done now that the other ones, like AT&T, could sit there and say, well, Comcast is getting a deal with Netflix to sort this out, so we're not going to just increase our capacity. We're going to work a deal, too.
The phrase slippery slope was used earlier in the show, and I think that's an apt phrase. So far, we really haven't seen much of these kinds of agreements in the provision of Internet services, but now we have a big one, and between two big players, and you really have to wonder, is that going to set the stage for more and more of these kinds of agreements, and might it crowd out some services that from players that just don't have the capacity to participate in this sort of fee-for-service world? Nobody knows the answer to that question. It's we're sort of in the Wild West of this arrangement at the moment, but I think it is a real danger, and somehow we have to get it sorted out what role the regulators are going to play in trying to ensure that bad outcomes along the lines of the kind of innovation that we've seen for many years now on the Internet doesn't get stifled as a result of these kinds of agreements. That's really a big fear, is that, you know, you can't play on the services end unless you pay big fees, and so there's lots of potentially valuable services that just never appear.
Mm-hmm. Dana, your thoughts on that?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question
for
me?
Just in terms of, you know, the door has now been opened to this idea that Internet service providers might be able to sign deals with companies like Netflix. So if there are other Internet service providers, Ken articulated a vision for where things ought to go in terms of a collaborative arrangement on figuring this out. But if I were another Internet service provider, I might say, well, wait a minute, why would I pour all this money in of my own if I could go work a deal with Netflix or any other of the big providers like that? So I'm just curious, I mean, do you think we're on the road in that direction now?
Unfortunately, yes. I do think that the Comcast deal will be a bellwether for other ISPs, and I think you will see something of a pile-on, and a pile-on might be a little bit of a loaded term, but definitely a domino effect where the deal with Comcast does inspire and is the catalyst for similar deals with other ISPs, definitely the AT&Ts of the world, the Verizons of the world, and that's just the U.S., surely other countries also. And I think you have seen that in Norway as well.
Right. Ken, I want to follow up on the second part of what you said in there, is the flipping of this to go the opposite direction. If there were going to be kind of one person paying the other, I could see Netflix ideally wanting the ISPs to say, hey, the content that Netflix is providing is valuable enough to our customers that we'll pay Netflix for it. How do you make that case to the ISPs that they should be doing it that direction?
Yeah, I think what we do, I mean, what we actually typically do is make the case that because there is that ambiguity. So on the one hand, the ISP could say, well, you know, you're driving a significant amount of volume on our network. Why don't you pay for it? On the other hand, Netflix could say, one of the reasons your subscribers find value in high-speed broadband is to access services like Netflix. You should pay us so your subscribers can access that content. Since there's, you know, rational arguments to be made on either side, we feel like a better place to land is to agree that there is a mutual exchange of value. And so the right place to balance on is a $0 exchange for those kinds of interconnections where the content provider is just satisfying requests for the from the ISP's network. Because we feel like $0 is kind of a stable balance point. There's, again, that concept of mutual exchange of value, where if it's non-zero, then one side's always going to want it to go up and one side's always going to want it to go down.
Right. David, you're an economist. How about this mutual exchange of value? Is that a realistic thing to hope for?
Well, it is the principle on which most of this has been done for, you know, really since the Internet came into all of our homes. So we've seen it work. But the industry's maturing now. The volume of data that's being exchanged is a lot greater, especially for certain kinds of services. And so, you know, we may be seeing the beginnings of a situation where it's not so sustainable. And through this period of time when it's prevailed for the most part, it's also been a period when it wasn't exactly clear what the rules were. The FCC has stepped in, you know, a few times and sort of tried to promulgate some rules, and basically, so far at least, they've been beaten back in the courts. It could be the ISPs, the Comcasts of the world are sort of getting bolder now and saying, okay, you know, we think we've won the legal argument. Now we're going to go after the dollars. We're right on the edge of this, and we just don't know where it's going to go from here.
Right. And are there other examples that might help us predict how this might shake out?
Well, when telephone services, ordinary phone services were deregulated, there was a lot of contentious debate about interconnection between competing phone companies, and some of that was wireless as well. At that time, the rules of the game that were laid out were that the competing companies competing, for example, for local telephone service to provide local service to end users were to sort of go off and negotiate some kind of interconnection agreement so that when you pick up your phone and you're buying your phone service from company X and you want to call somebody who buys their phone service from company Y, your call actually goes through. A lot of those interconnection kinds of negotiations didn't end very well. And in the end, the regulators in a number of cases had to step in and just impose some kind of agreement on the parties. Right now with internet services, it's not exactly clear how much authority some of the regulators have to do that. So the rules of the game are really not very well established.
Right. Ken, what's your understanding of what the regulators could or couldn't do in this situation?
It's a complex area. I agree with David that part of what we're seeing here, it's kind of a fascinating moment in history where the internet is really evolving from a kind of basic communications platform to a more sophisticated content delivery platform, where that's very, in very broad terms, all kinds of content are being made available to us. And it's not clear kind of what the ultimate economic or regulatory environment will look like. Certainly, the open internet order that was vacated recently by the courts did so on the basis that, on a kind of a technical basis, that the provision under the Telecommunications Act that the FCC had used to classify the internet did not support the level of what's called common carrier requirement that was the foundation for the open internet order. There's the possibility that the FCC could reclassify internet communications to be more like telecommunications. There's the FCC is currently taking input on that, and part of the reason for the timing of our publishing of the network neutrality. Of our network neutrality position was to take advantage of that opportunity for filing. And then there's a number of other paths that a regulatory environment could potentially follow.
Right. Dana, what's your take on this? In terms of what the FCC could or might do here?
To Ken's point, I would have mentioned the possible reclassification as a common carrier. I would say that it may have been a misstep not to pursue that more explicitly and more aggressively earlier, but that's where we're at. We're at a point right now where ISPs are not currently considered common carriers and don't enjoy the privileges that telecoms might under that classification. So I think that is perhaps the best the FCC can do is retool its legal argument and maybe more explicitly go after that common carrier, status. You know, to Professor Mandy's point earlier, it's a little tough to say where exactly we're going. It is a very exciting time. It's a very dynamic time. It's tough to see where exactly we're going, but that does seem to be the FCC's best bet.
Okay.
If I could speculate here for a minute,
please.
About the motives. Of the Federal Communications Commission, I think that they've been widely criticized for sort of basing their open internet order on sort of weak legal principles, and you know the courts have sort of ruled against them. So apparently, there's something to those criticisms. But I think they were probably trying to avoid getting too deep into the regulatory structure, I think they're very much aware of the kinds of unintended consequences that can come from heavy regulation that that I mentioned earlier. And so they're sort of walking a balance beam here, trying to do enough to avoid some of the bad outcomes that might happen in an unregulated environment, but not to get so involved that they end up providing incentives for potential participants in the market to not innovate or to not invest sufficient capacity to carry the bandwidth that we all want to use. And so they tried this sort of light approach to imposing open internet rules, and it didn't pass legal muster. So are they going to take the step to sort of reclassify internet service providers as common carriers? And that itself would probably be challenged legally if they tried. They might. If they do and they succeed, well, then they have much heavier regulatory tools that they can use. But they still have this issue of how do you deploy those tools without creating unintended consequences? And that's really a fundamental problem for regulation of any sort in, not just in internet services, but across the board.
Okay, once again, for our audience, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner, and today we're talking about net neutrality and the way that internet bandwidth is allocated and regulated. Joining us in the studio is David Mandy, professor of economics at the University of Missouri, and via Skype we have Dana Woolman, the managing editor of the online magazine Engadget, and we also have Ken Florence, the vice president of content delivery at Netflix. For those of you in our audience, we have a little bit more time for you to weigh in if you'd like to. One thing you could talk about is the capacity for the internet streaming. If it's going to be controlled, what kinds of content do you think should be given preference, or who do you think should be able to make some of those decisions? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us, intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet at us. Our handle is @KBIA. Feel free to call in with questions for our panelists as well, if you'd prefer to do that. We just have a little bit of time left, though, in our show. We do have a caller on the line. Kent from Columbia is with us. Kent, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Kent, thanks for joining our program today, for listening and calling in.
No problem. Yes, I am a Netflix user and have been for a long time, and I follow the stock and the news related to it. And I also use Amazon Prime for their streaming services. And I've completely replaced my usage of cable with this. Now, I love these services, and I use them. It's 90% of what I do on the internet is using these kinds of services. And I pay quite a bit of money every month to have a high download speed. And when I heard that Netflix had also paid Comcast to stream their videos and stuff faster, first of all, I was happy because that meant less buffering on my end. But also it seemed like they were double dipping because I'm already paying for their maximum download package so that I could avoid buffering problems. And now Netflix is coming in and paying them again. And it just seems like, especially with the way the internet's going, that it is more of a utility than a luxury now. It is necessary for a lot of different things we do in our lives. And that perhaps some sort of regulation is in place so they don't get to double dip as much as they would like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kent, thanks for calling in and sharing that. Ken Florence, I want to throw that to you. I mean, does Netflix feel like you're getting tacked with a double dip from the ISPs?
I think that's an accurate way to put it. And I think one of the things, one of the ways to bring that into focus is to think about if this was a common practice that happened across all networks, then that would be one thing. What we actually find, and we operate in the U.S. and many other countries around the world, is it's actually not common for that double dipping to happen. And the only places that we find that kind of double dipping to happen is where a relatively where very, very large scale companies control internet access, as opposed to the kind of robust competition that that David referred to earlier. There's some mechanisms, in fact, that can drive that kind of competition, but those are not present in the U.S. So I agree with Kent's point that, certainly he's paying premium price for high-speed service, that high-speed service is well in excess of what's required to deliver a great Netflix experience or Amazon Prime experience. And so he should have every right to expect that that service comes to him in an unimpeded fashion in full quality. And unfortunately, you know, we've had to make a compromise to make sure Kent does that get that service, and we may have to do so in the future. But at the same time, we'll advocate for an ultimate outcome that we think is consistent with the continued robust evolution of the internet.
Right. David, you're an economist. Do you see a problem with this in terms of the way that the ISP, Comcast in particular, is handling this?
Well, there's an aspect of this that really hasn't been mentioned very explicitly that I think concerns a lot of people, which is the fact that some of the internet service providers are providing competing products with companies like Netflix or others, other websites that end users might want to use. So, you know, might it be the case that some download speeds are being manipulated to make, I'm just going to keep picking on Netflix since they're on the line here, but to make a Netflix product not so pleasant in order to try to induce the end user to, you know, buy the premium cable package and watch the movie as provided by Comcast as part of its cable service. So you've got some of these internet service providers are sort of, you know, they're providing pipes that others need to use to deliver their services, but they're also in competition with those same providers for retail services that the end users want. And that's a sort of an uneasy situation, right? You can imagine that Comcast would just love to get a bunch of users of competing services to dump their competing services and buy Comcast cable services instead. This is an issue. We haven't mentioned it yet today, but it's part of this whole landscape. How do we sort of let Comcast do their business, earn a reasonable profit on the very substantial investments they make, but not abuse their market position at the same time?
Right. Dana, is it your sense that that may be some of what's going on here or might be happening here in the future?
Absolutely. I think there's definitely potential for it. And this was something we've heard from I may have mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you may have heard this from consumer advocates, internet advocates. There has definitely been this concern, as Professor Mandy says, that ISPs might manipulate their own services to favor services that they're offering themselves that might compete with the Netflixes of the world and the Amazon Primes of the world, the Hulus of the world. It definitely is a concern, and I do think that the way the law is written right now, it's a little hard to tell, perhaps, when a site like Netflix, when its speeds are dropping, it's a little hard to tell, at least from an outward-facing perspective, from a consumer perspective, whether that's because of deliberate throttling or if it's a capacity issue. I know I've looked at Netflix's speed reports, and you can see a precipitous drop, a very sudden drop on both Verizon and Comcast. And there isn't much insight there from a consumer perspective. It is tough to tell when it's strategic and deliberate and a result of manipulation, and when it's just that the ISPs are struggling to keep up for whatever reason. And I think that is a little troubling that from a regular person's perspective, it's the possibility is always there for manipulation, but a regular person might not know.
And is there a way to make that more transparent? Would it be possible, do you think?
Frankly, I don't know how you make that more transparent. I think Netflix has done a good thing in at least publishing some what they call their speed reports. But even looking at those, I don't know how you break it down and identify to what extent deliberate manipulation was a factor versus just a capacity issue with growing traffic versus the available server space.
Right. Ken, how does Netflix approach this? I mean, you're going, as David said, onto networks where you're relying on them to move your service into a space that competes with other offerings that they have.
Yeah, I think certainly there are two powerful motivators. If you're an ISP at this scale and you are a video service provider at this scale, you have a powerful motivators on both sides. You have the potential on the one hand to constrain capacity, essentially to create scarcity in a resource that should not be scarce, and then, you know, charge a price for that resource. And you have a motivation to resist competition by other services that might be taking viewership away from your video service. So from our perspective, you know, one or both dynamics may be at play in different, and maybe different one predominates in different situations. In either case, I think it's pretty straightforward to just advocate for a position that says, you know, that kind of undue leverage shouldn't be exerted. To Dana's point, you know, I think what Dana's question or the point she was getting to points out kind of an interesting issue, which is, you know, for a long time, all of us have lived with the concept of speed tests on the internet, and most of us can go home and go to, you know, a speed test website and see that we're getting something very close to what we're paying for in terms of that the tested capacity to our ISP. And the fact is that you know, David used the term earlier, last mile. In fact, that's what most of those speed tests are doing, is testing that last mile capacity. And then to Dana's point, there's an additional question of, okay, if that last mile capacity is there, then how do I know what's causing things to speed up or slow down to other services on the broader internet? And so I think there's a little bit of a groundswell lately of various people trying to think about ways that we could measure not only that last mile capacity, but actual capacity to the services that people care about, whether that's Netflix or YouTube or Facebook or whatever it might be.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we are about out of time here, so we're going to have to end on that note. I want to thank you for joining us for our Intersection program today. Thanks also to our guests, David Mandy, Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Dana Woolman, Managing Editor of the online magazine Engadget, and Ken Florence, Vice President of Content Delivery at Netflix. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch our live streaming video each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Bridget Bowden and Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangware. Pat Akers is our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Pemuliner. Thank you for joining us today, and have a great week.